Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stager. It's illegal to take a photo of your completed ballot in Ohio, and it's been that way for decades. But the idea of a secret ballot isn't as old as you might think. Our founding fathers debated whether secret voting was cowardly, and nonpartisan ballots, those that have every candidate's name on them, those weren't around when we first started voting either. On this election day, we're exploring the strange and sometimes violent history of the American ballot. And joining me on this trip through electoral time is Ohio State University law professor Anthony Goggin. He teaches both constitutional and election law and has written about voting in revolutionary and colonial America. Happy Election Day, Professor.
Thank you. Happy Election Day to you, Anna.
I want to start with what might have actually been a stolen presidential election. I'm not talking about 2020. Biden won that election. I'm talking about 1888 between Democrat Grover Cleveland and Republican Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland was the incumbent, and it was all coming down to a handful of states, if that sounds familiar. The Republicans hired this unsavory character named W.W. Dudley, who essentially bought a bunch of votes in Indiana from men who would sell their votes to the highest bidder and others who would vote more than once, sometimes in disguise. He even ferried men from Pennsylvania, which was not a swing state, over to vote in Indiana. Harrison won Indiana, won the presidential race, but a campaign memo, how classic, right, got out about this plan, and newspapers blasted the deception, but Harrison became president anyway.
That's right. And certainly there also was extensive voter suppression across the South in 1888. In the late 19th century, the vast majority of African Americans were Republicans and the vast majority of white Southerners were Democrats. And by 1888, there had been systematic disenfranchisement of African American men across the South, which meant although the Democrats won all of the former states of the Confederacy, their victories were predicated in part on the fact that they had unconstitutionally disenfranchised over a million African-American men in the South, or at least many hundreds of thousands of African-American men in the South. So the 1888 election was characterized by rampant fraud and voter suppression.
Grover Cleveland, who lost, didn't go away quietly, though. He started saying that our voting system needed one serious overhaul. Now, he didn't get into the whole literacy test poll tax. That comes about 100 years after he's gone. But he did call on Americans to, quote, restore the purity of their suffrage. Ballot reform sweeps the nation. And in 1892, he is returned to the White House. He is the only president so far to do non-consecutive terms.
That's right. What's also interesting about Cleveland is he did win the popular vote in 1888, at least among ballots that actually were cast by voters. So he won three consecutive popular votes. But of course, the Electoral College is what determines who's elected president. In 1892, he won the popular vote and a majority in the Electoral College, which resulted in him in being the thus far only president to be elected non-consecutively.
What's wild to me about the 1888 election is I think about how our elections work now, and we just kind of assume that's how we've always done it. We have a secret ballot. Our government provides us a ballot with all of the candidates. You have to register to vote. But none of these things really existed when our nation began.
That's right. Certainly, the first elections in American history predate the creation of the United States. They date to the colonial period. Virginia held its first legislative elections in the 1610s, and Massachusetts held its first legislative elections for the colonial legislature in the 1620s. And at that time, voice voting was the way the vast majority of elections were conducted. So the idea was there would be an election official who would be sitting at a table, and you would approach the election official and you would publicly announce who you were voting for. And oftentimes during the colonial period and into the early national period, the competing candidates would be standing next to the election official. And in a number of jurisdictions, it was permissible for the candidate who had received the voter's vote to shake the voter's hand to thank them. And conversely, it was also very common in the colonial period for the supporters of the two contending candidates to engage in what was essentially electioneering. They would hoot and holler in support when a voter would cast their vote for their favorite candidate, and they would boo when the voters voted for the opposing candidate. So our elections were really quite raucous during the colonial period and early national period, which is probably very different than what most people would have assumed would have been the case during the early years of American history.
Aside, practicality aside, in a state where 8 million people could cast their ballots in this election, I can't imagine having to stand and say in front of Sherrod Brown and Bernie Moreno, look them both in the eye and be like, this is how I'm voting.
Yes. And in fact, even some of the most famous people in American history, most famous presidents in American history participated in this system. George Washington, for example, who we all remember as our nation's first president, the father of the nation. Well, in his first successful race for office in 1758, he was elected to the colonial legislature in Virginia called the House of Burgesses, and that was done through voice voting. And he got a list of all the voters who voted and how they voted, and he alphabetized the list of people who had voted against him in 1758. We don't know what he did with that, but he certainly was very interested in it. And there's actually another interesting aspect to the Washington story. What would probably shock people to learn is that in the colonial period and deep into the 1800s, the candidates were expected to buy alcohol for the voters on election day. It was a practice known as treating, and it really reflected the fact that the vast majority of people who were elected to colonial legislatures and to state legislatures and Congress in the early national period were from the upper classes. And so the voters were mostly people from what today we would call the working classes. And the expectation was that the working class would defer to the elite, and that the elite elected leaders are going to come from. But on election day, the elite were expected to show their respect for the voters by throwing a party for them, buying alcohol. And in George Washington's first race for elective office in Virginia in 1755, he refused to buy alcohol, mostly because he was a very financially conservative person. And so he thought that his name was well known enough. He was only in his early 20s at the time, but was from a famous family. And he thought, I'll be able to win this election without engaging in this expensive habit of treating the voters. Well, he lost. And in 1758, when he ran again, we have a letter that letters he exchanged with his campaign manager, because Washington was serving during the French and Indian War in Pennsylvania. And in one of the letters, he instructs the campaign manager to buy as much alcohol as he can get his hands on. And the campaign manager writes back and says, we bought over 150 gallons of alcohol. And Washington responds by saying, my only worry is that you spent with too sparing a hand. Well, as it turns out, the alcohol did do the trick. Washington won the 1758 House of Burgesses race. And one historian has pointed out, Washington got about 300 votes in that race. So basically, he got 2 votes for every gallon of alcohol that he purchased in 1758.
I love that we were deciding who to vote for based on whether or not they were buying us a drink afterwards.
Yes, it's sort of like today where we say, is this a candidate you'd like to have a beer with? In that time period, the question is this a candidate you'd like to buy you a beer?
And while voice voting was pretty common, you could also raise your hand. You could walk to one side of the room or the other, kind of like the way we caucus. But, women didn't vote at the very beginning. Non-land-owning males didn't vote. There were even religious tests in certain states to ensure that only Christian men could vote.
That's right. Women were actually permitted to vote in New Jersey immediately after the Revolution until 1807. So it's interesting. The notion of women voting was not a foreign concept during the late 18th and 19th centuries, but New Jersey stripped women of the right to vote in 1807 through a constitutional amendment. Of course, we did not see the 19th Amendment adopted for another 100 years. African American men, we know, did vote in most of the northern states as of 1787. And indigenous men also, we know, voted in some parts of New England during the colonial period and early national period. But it's absolutely true that white men represented the vast majority of the electorate as a product of law and the systematic disenfranchisement of the great majority of people who were not white men during the colonial period in the first 140 years of our country's history as a nation.
So the word ballot now is synonymous with a piece of paper, or I guess increasingly a screen that appears on a voting machine, but it actually comes from the Italian word for little ball.
That's right. And it reflects the fact that both in Europe as well as in America, we've used many different voting methods to enable voters to communicate who they're voting for. Objects certainly were used in the early history of both the colonies and the United States in contexts where paper was hard to come by, or in jurisdictions where voice voting wasn't used because they didn't have a method to record the vote. So that's why they would then turn to objects to have a clear record of how the vote had actually come out.
Yeah, they used peas, little type marbles, pebbles, even bullets in some cases. Colonial Pennsylvania voted by tossing beans in a hat, which I kind of love. But part of that was also maybe a little bit of literacy, right? Not every voter could read, could write out a name for the person they wanted to vote for.
That's right. And one aspect of voice voting that was important was that the voice vote would be recorded by an election official, so it didn't require someone to know how to spell the name of the candidate that they were voting for. And a lot of controversies emerged in the colonies and later the states that had developed early ballots because different factions would write down the name of the candidate in advance for the voter. And there would be many objections to that. And so then over time, the expectation was that a voter could look at a piece of paper that listed the candidates and then choose to copy the one who they supported. So our early voting system certainly was one that was not standardized, varied widely from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and really reflected the fact that democracy was in its early stages in America.
Yeah, Ohio started requiring voting by ballot in 1802, so we were pretty early on the adoption. Kentucky voted with their voices until 1891, so opposite end of the spectrum. But when we started voting on pieces of paper, it wasn't the ballot we see today. In a lot of cases, you had to bring your own scrap of paper.
That's right. And the parties in the 19th century would provide what they called tickets. They were called tickets because they looked like railroad tickets. And they would list, each scrap of paper would have a candidate for a particular office on that ticket. And over time, as elections became larger and larger, as the country grew, by the middle of the 19th century, there were over 30 million Americans. And so it was necessary to have a more professional voting system and have a paper record of each ballot as it was cast. And so the notion that a voter would express their vote in writing in paper became an entrenched feature of our politics in the great majority of jurisdictions roughly by the time of the Civil War, although the secret ballot would not become a widespread feature of American elections until the late 19th century. So during the Civil War era, when you showed up with a ballot, that would typically be a ballot that was provided by one of the political parties and often was color-coded. So if you're voting for Abraham Lincoln, that would be pretty obvious because you'd show up with a ballot that was of the color of the Republican Party ticket. And conversely, if you're voting for the Democrat, it would be pretty obvious to people as you approach the polling place who it was you were supporting.
Yeah. And I get not writing it down yourself because you had to remember how to spell the candidates' names. Like, I'm pretty sure we can all spell Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, but can you spell the name of your state representative? What about the three justices you might have voted for the Ohio State Supreme Court? Like, I remember when Lisa Murkowski of Alaska mounted a successful write-in campaign. They are hard for a reason these days. She gave out thousands and thousands of those little rubber, like Live Strong style bracelets that were really popular with her name stamped on them because you could wear the bracelet into the polling place and remember how to spell Murkowski.
That's right. And in many ways, that harkened back to the early voting history of America, where assistance had to be provided to the candidate, to the voters in being able to specifically identify which candidate it was that they supported. So in some ways, the more things change, the more they resemble our early history.
These political party ballots got some pushback initially, but we started voting with them. But what I find really fascinating is that we also started handing them out with money, which wasn't illegal at the time. So the parties were like, we'll print hundreds of ballots. We'll be outside the place where you have to turn your ballot in, and we'll give you a ballot and a couple bucks and send you on your way.
It absolutely varied state to state and jurisdiction by jurisdiction, the extent to which they regulated the issue of vote buying, but it certainly was a widespread problem in many parts of the country in the 19th century. It certainly was perceived as a widespread problem, as both parties would accuse the other of buying votes. Republicans especially would accuse Democrats of it in the North, because the Democratic Party was more dependent on the support of immigrants from Ireland and Germany, France, whereas the Republican Party in the 19th century was a party that received a larger share of its support from people who were born in the United States. Conversely, in the South, the Democratic Party was very rooted in the white South, with people who had deep ties to the region. So even within one political party, the Democratic Party, in the 19th century, you could see a really remarkable diversity of constituencies and a really diverse election system that then gave rise to all kinds of efforts by both sides to find an angle to make it easier for their particular supporters to vote. So again, there are aspects of America in the 19th century that very much resemble controversies we have in the 21st century.
Yeah, we also didn't have voter registration laws in every state, or how you proved that you lived there was inconsistent, which is how President Harrison's team allegedly brought voters from Pennsylvania to Indiana, because another local Indianan could be like, oh yeah, that's Todd, he lives down the road from me, and no other proof would be required.
It really did depend on local election administrators, the extent to which they were enforcing the law. And one of the unique features of American elections today and then is the fact that many of our election officials are themselves elected, which then means that there's partisan control of the election administration process, which does distinguish us from countries like Canada and many of our peer democracies around the world. But again, that's not a new issue. It's one that's deeply rooted in our history.
So this all sort of culminates as we get into the late 1800s after the Civil War. The most notorious vote fraudster is probably Boss Tweed in New York. In 1868, a presidential election year, Tweed is accused of casting more than 50,000 illegal votes in New York City.
And that's right. And it's impossible to ascertain the full extent of it.
Yeah.
In part because his political opponents really emphasized the fraud that was occurring and whether or not it was fraud. But Tweed absolutely became synonymous with the idea of
voter fraud, for sure,
Anna.
He later gets arrested and he dies in jail for embezzling money from the state of New York. So lots of issues with his morality.
That's right. He was certainly a very colorful figure, but also a very controversial figure.
Coming up, how we got the radical idea that our governments should print our ballots with all the candidates on them. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Americans have the right to vote for their representatives in government, but the right to a ballot with all the candidates provided by the state and kept a secret, that's not exactly how our founding fathers saw things going. We're talking about the history of the American ballot this election day, and we're still with Ohio State University law professor Anthony Goggin. He teaches constitutional and election law and writes about voting in revolutionary and colonial America. When we left off, political parties were printing ballots for us. There was a lot of corruption, a lot of problems with voter registration, and making sure that the right people were voting in the right places. So then, Australia, the continent of Australia, enters the chat. Can you tell us about the Australian ballot and the Australian way of voting?
Yes, Anna, the main innovation that Australia offered was to provide voters with privacy when it came to expressing their vote so that they weren't subject to pressure either by the political parties or maybe by an employer or maybe even by members of their family. And that notion was actually pretty controversial because there was a counterargument, which was that voters should stand by their vote. They should not be ashamed of how they voted, and they should have the courage of their convictions by publicly announcing it. The other concern with the secret ballot was tied to fraud. If you have a secret voting system, that means that there's no name associated with each ballot. And so that creates the potential risk that someone can introduce fake ballots into the voting process. And that's one reason why the Australian ballot didn't immediately take hold in the 19th century. It required a number of election cycles before it became a standard feature of American elections.
Yeah, the Massachusetts legislature in 1851 said, quote, "To say that the citizen shall vote with a sealed bag or not at all is an act of despotism." Like, I mean, there was serious criticism of the private ballot.
That's right. And in fairness, some of that criticism was coming from people who were used to coercing voters.
This is fair.
So they certainly realized from the standpoint of the political machines, both Democratic and Republican, they were very fearful they're going to lose their ability to, quote unquote, deliver a vote confidently. And so a lot of the advocates of the secret ballot were progressives. The term had a different meaning then than it does today. Progressives were found both in the Republican and Democratic parties in the early 20th century, late 19th century. But one common theme among the progressives was that they believed the big urban political machines were manipulating the votes of immigrants, especially immigrants from Ireland, Italy, and Germany. And many of the progressives were of English heritage, and they believed that a secret ballot would allow the immigrants to cast their votes without being coerced by the party machines. Now, ironically, there really was no significant change in voting patterns after the secret ballot was adopted. So whatever the long-term goals of the reformers, they probably didn't achieve a partisan advantage, but certainly it gave, on an individual level, voters much more freedom to cast a ballot consistent with their conscience rather than what the sort of social environment they were moving in would expect.
Yeah, it's a pretty logical argument, right? Like, your landlord shouldn't influence how their tenant votes. Employers shouldn't influence how their employees vote. The idea that you could lose your housing or your job because of who you voted for seems unfair.
That's right. And that was the driving argument in the end in favor of the secret ballot. And once the secret ballot became widespread across the country, people grew to like it. People grew to trust it. And it now, of course, is a cornerstone feature of American elections.
Yeah. It also brought voting indoors. Contained it in these little compartments. The voting booth is essentially born around this time. It makes elections like safer, quieter, more orderly, less likely to. There's even some famous cases of the people carrying partisan ballots being attacked, beaten, shot.
That's right. And what's interesting is we still see in caucuses today in some states an open voting method. And it was without question a much more boisterous election environment than what we see with our primary and general elections, where the voting process is a very subdued process where there's no electioneering. I'm from Iowa. I'm a visiting professor at Ohio State this fall, but I'm originally from Iowa. And in the Iowa caucuses on the Democratic side, historically, voters voted with their feet. For example, in a caucus, if you supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 or you supported Bernie Sanders, the caucus might be held in a high school gymnasium and all the Sanders supporters would stand on one end and the Clinton supporters on the other. And they, after the first round of voting, the Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters would be allowed to yell out to the other side, to neighbors, and say, come on over to Hillary's side of the gym, here underneath the basket. And then Sanders supporters would do the same. So when it comes to caucuses, we see an era before the secret ballot, and it really underscores how dramatically the secret ballot transformed American elections into a much more sober and quiet affair at the polling places themselves.
Yeah, by 1896, 39 of our 45 states cast secret government-printed ballots, so it was almost universal by that point. This is also the time when we start using machines to vote, which were also met with a lot of skepticism. The first punch card machine patent was in 1889, and the first lever voting machine, which I remember my mom pulling when I was a kid, debuted in 1892. So we start to mechanize it.
That's right. As mechanization spread across the society in all aspects of American life, it also spread to voting places. And it really reflected ultimately the fact that the country had grown so large. So by the early 1900s, there are now over 100 million Americans. The older methods of voting simply would not work in an election system where tens of millions of ballots are being cast. And so mechanization remains a central feature of American elections.
Even though there's conversation these days about going back to hand counting.
That's right. Certainly there have been some proposals, but even if you look at the smallest state, the scale of hand tabulation would be enormous and would then result in elections taking much, much longer to determine an outcome. So I guess if the country decided it would be okay waiting a month to find out who won, then maybe hand counting would be viable, although you would also need a lot more volunteers to serve as election administrators. I should point out, of course, as many of your listeners undoubtedly, Anna, will remember, in 2000, we had an election that took over a month to decide who the president was, and voters were very unhappy with that delay. And so I suspect as voters head to the polls today, we might be grateful that we do have an election system that it's quicker in ascertaining who the winner is than would have been the case in the 1800s for certain.
Yeah, we're all lamenting that it could go to Thursday, Friday, Saturday, let alone that it would go well into December.
That's right. That's exactly right.
My anxiety could never. Although it's what I also find really fascinating is, you know, every new piece of technology that we introduce, whether it's printed ballots, whether it's voting machines, whether it's, you know, we move to electronic counting, it's always met with skepticism and with questions about its constitutionality.
Yes, certainly the 2020 election saw a tremendous amount of controversy surrounding mail-in ballots. And we saw a record number of mail-in ballots in 2020. But on the other hand, what's really interesting about the 2020 election is that it was a record-setting election in terms of turnout. 158 million Americans voted in the 2020 presidential election. That was the highest turnout level the country has seen since 1900, since the McKinley-Bryan race. And that's also the highest turnout level since the adoption of the 19th Amendment in 1920, which extended a constitutional right to vote to women. So by really any measure, the 2020 election was the highest turnout election in modern history, which I think ultimately reflects the fact that we have made voting much easier for people to participate in. And that's a good thing because I think whatever your politics are, Republican or Democrat, I think most of us are pleased to see very high turnout rates because they reflect the idea that voters still see the democratic process as being something important, valuable, and worth participating in. So I think high turnouts are something to welcome.
Well, I'm going to take a turn here. in that the 15th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified in 1870. This is around the same time that we're converting to secret ballots, we're getting voting machines, and the 15th Amendment ensured that people could not be denied the right to vote because of their race. But that doesn't mean that suddenly all people of color got to go vote freely. Literacy tests, poll taxes, all kinds of barriers started popping up almost as soon as this right was guaranteed.
Certainly in the South. So in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was adopted, in 1870, when the 15th Amendment was adopted, the vast majority of African Americans lived in the South. And they, African American men, were voting in many, in all the Southern states in the early 1870s. And that did lead to major Republican victories during the Reconstruction era, because as I indicated before, the vast majority of African Americans were Republicans in the 1870s. In an effort to retake control of the Southern states, the Democratic Party, which in those days, as I said before, in the
Dixiecrats.
South, they were virtually 100% white, and it was a white supremacist party. The Democrats worked systematically to disenfranchise African Americans, and they certainly did so through election mechanisms, as you said, Anna, such as the literacy test. And of course, the literacy test was itself fraudulent, because the election administrators would often use a passage of the Constitution in French or Latin. Oftentimes, the election administrators themselves didn't speak French or Latin. So the whole thing was a charade designed to prevent African-American men from registering and voting. The other aspect of this was the Southern Democratic Party in the late 19th century conducted a brutal and vicious campaign of terrorism and violence against Republican voters, white and black, in the South. And it ultimately resulted by the 1890s in the virtual complete disenfranchisement of African Americans in the South, even though the 15th Amendment provided for a constitutional right to vote for African American men. By the end of the 1890s, voter registration rates among African American men in the South were in the single digits, low single digits, and it would not be until the passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that African American registration rates reached levels outside the single digits and ultimately got deep into the 60 percentile, 70 percentiles comparable to white voters at the time.
Yeah, I have some sample questions from some of these voting literacy tests, and they are wild. So I tried to take Louisiana's test. It had 30 questions to be answered in 10 minutes. Some of them were confusingly written, to say the least. 30 questions in 10 minutes means you get to spend maybe 20 seconds per question. And any wrong answer constituted a fail. So you had to get it all right. And some of them were like this, which threw me, which was, divide a vertical line in two equal parts by bisecting it with a curved horizontal line that is only straight at the spot of bisection of the vertical. And I'm like, okay, I still got to think about that for a second.
And the administrators of those tests wouldn't have been able to come up with the answer themselves. The whole thing was a charade by the Southern state governments at the time, controlled by the Democratic Party, designed to keep the white supremacists in power in the South. So it really did take the power of the federal government through the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 to end those nefarious practices in the Deep South. And then ironically, within two decades of the Voting Rights Act, we see white Southerners move to the Republican Party, and the solid South that had once been Democratic became a solid South for the Republican Party. And African-American voters who voted overwhelmingly Republican, at least until the 1930s, they then began to move over to the Democratic Party. So it's interesting that despite these efforts to manipulate election law to achieve a particular end, the electorate itself is also in a constant state of change, and it can become very unpredictable which side will benefit from a particular election rule. That wasn't the case for most of the segregationist period in the South, because the Democrats were so systematic and violent in their application of their disenfranchising policies. But in general, election laws have, at least in the last 30 years, I'd say, have not had predictable results in particular, the adoption of voter ID laws has been super controversial across the country. And there are many predictions of voter ID laws would result in a suppression of votes. But the irony is we are seeing sky-high levels of turnout in an era of voter ID laws and an era of stricter regulations governing voter registration and the casting of ballots. As I said, the 2020 election was the highest turnout election in 120 years. The 2018 and 2022 midterms were the highest midterms in this century. So election laws sometimes have unpredictable consequences.
And if you're curious about whether you can pass a poll test, you can go online later today to our Facebook page, All Sides, WOSU All Sides, or on Instagram. I'll have some sample questions, including ones from Ohio's test, like, in what year did Congress gain the right to prohibit the migration of persons to the states? Coming up, we're going to talk about the Voting Rights Act and the modern era of voting. That's when All Sides continues. On 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Today is Election Day, and we're talking about the history of the American ballot. Still with us is Ohio State University professor Anthony Goggin. We've reached the modern era. So Congress passes the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, which lets people vote regardless of their race in 1870. But as we said, it's not until March of 1965 that activists organize marches from Selma, Alabama, to the state capital of Montgomery to spotlight the fact that despite having the right to vote, many of them just can't because of poll taxes, literacy tests, and outright voter suppression. This first march is even marked by violence. Police attack the protesters, and it becomes known as Bloody Sunday.
That's right. Selma became an iconic event. John Lewis, a famous member of Congress, was brutally attacked in Alabama, and it became a symbol of how American democracy had really been made into a mockery by this 100-year practice in the South of disenfranchising African-American voters. And what made it different than previous marches was the pro-Voting Rights Act protesters in the 60s were able to conduct their marches under the scrutiny of the national television media. And so Americans in the North saw what was happening in the South. And not only were Northerners appalled by it, they also were embarrassed by it because we were in the middle of the Cold War at the time with the Soviet Union. We were competing with the Soviets for support across the world, especially in the Third World. And we proclaimed ourselves to be the great nation of liberty and freedom and democracy. And here, people around the world could see that the Americans did not live up to their ideals, that millions of Americans were being disenfranchised on the basis of their race. And so all these events combined to create momentum to pass the Voting Rights Act in Congress in 1965, which is exactly what happened.
Yeah, it bans literacy tests and then later iterations put in protections for people who can't read English, those with disabilities. It also puts additional restrictions on states with histories of voter suppression, requiring federal approval for election changes. I mean, it is monumental in terms of how it changes voting, particularly in the South.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Anne, as you said, the preclearance provisions of the Voting Rights Act were not limited to the South because there were parts, jurisdictions in the North and the West that had a history of discrimination in voting. Now, there's a famous Supreme Court case called Shelby County v. Holder that was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court about a decade ago.
Later in my notes, yeah.
That's right. Yes, we can talk about it then. But that invalidated a portion of the it invalidated the preclearance formula itself, how it was calculated to decide which jurisdictions in the country had an ongoing history of discrimination. But the VRA in 65 was transformative. It had immediate effects with regard to African-American participation in elections. We also saw African-Americans elected to mayoral races, congressional races. The VRA was a landmark. And I might add about the VRA, it was not passed in partisan fashion. It was passed with a large bipartisan majority. Many, many Republicans voted in favor of the Voting Rights Act, as well as Democrats. In fact, we'll have to check this, but off the top of my head, I believe a larger percentage of Republican members of Congress voted for the Voting Rights Act than Democrats, because, of course, Southern Democrats voted against it. They were, the Southern Democrat Party was the white supremacist party in the 1960s. And so the VRA is a great moment in our history, and it's one that Republicans and Democrats alike should celebrate.
Then, finally, we get a 24th Amendment to our Constitution in 1962. It gets ratified 2 years later, and it's unconstitutional to have a poll tax.
Yeah, the poll tax is really interesting because the poll tax today we see is just a naked effort to disenfranchise poor people. But historically, the idea that you would pay a tax was considered a progressive measure. Because, as you referred to earlier, Anna, our original voting qualification was limited not just to men, but also to property holders. It was this idea that you had to own 40 pounds worth of real property in order to be qualified to vote. Well, some jurisdictions developed a poll tax as a way to enable people who didn't own real property to vote. If you paid this tax on an annual basis, you'd be allowed to vote in elections in different parts of the country. But then over time, it became a tool to disenfranchise people, especially in jurisdictions where the poll tax was applied in a discriminatory fashion. In other words, the party in power would enforce the poll tax against voters who supported their opponents, and they would not enforce it against voters who supported them.
Finally, we get the 26th Amendment, which prohibited states and the federal government from using age as a reason to deny the vote to anyone 18 or older. It's kind of crazy to think that it's only been like 60, 70 years that we've been allowing 18-year-olds to vote.
That's right. And that constitutional amendment was really a product of the Vietnam War. So in the 1960s, the United States went to war in South Vietnam against Communist North Vietnam. And 18-year-olds were subject to the military draft. And hundreds of thousands of young American men were drafted into the Army and other service branches involuntarily and sent to fight in Vietnam. And it really became a source of national embarrassment that these young men were being sent to fight and die in a war that they had no political power to influence because they weren't eligible to vote. And so that created pressure to finally lower the mandatory vote, lower the voting age to 18 and require every state to allow people 18 and older to vote.
Do you think we'll ever lower it again?
I think there's a real chance it might happen to age 16. There are a lot of jurisdictions around the world who are experimenting with reducing their voting age to 16. The one qualifier I would add to that, or one caveat, is that if you did lower the voting age to 16, it might also then have second and third order effects in terms of what constitutes the age of majority. So I think it does.
For contracts, for crimes, for...
And certainly for parents' ability to tell their kids what to do when they're 16 and 17, once they're 18.
That's also fair.
They have the age of the majority. So I think this would ultimately be part of a bigger discussion of what constitutes adulthood. But yes, I certainly can envision a day where we will see some states lower the voting age to 16.
You know, what's fascinating is... when you look at early turnout, now we were a smaller country, it was like 80% or above, numbers that we just don't hit anymore. And in fact, in 1993, we had historically low rates of voter registration, so we passed a motor voter law. And so it's just then that we required states to let citizens register to vote when they applied for driver's licenses, offer mail-in registration, allow registration at public assistance offices. I guess I've always grown up with that, but it is really new in terms of our history.
That's right. And it was a response to, just exactly as you said, Anna, to lower voter turnout rates in the latter part of the 20th century. And the motor voter law and similar laws, the Help America Vote Act, have been really successful as we get now deep into the 2020s, as evidenced by the high voter turnout rates we are experiencing in 2018, 2020, 2022. And we certainly have every reason to believe 2024 will be another very, very high turnout election. The last time I checked this morning, 80 million Americans have already voted in the 2024 election. So I think that 158 million number that we reached in 2020 is something to watch in 2024. And if we do reach it, I think part of the reason will be because of the innovations that were made in the 1990s and early 2000s to make it easier to vote.
Yeah, what I found fascinating was back in 1993, the first year that that motor voter law goes into effect, more than 30 million Americans completed their voter registration or updated their registration. That's not an insignificant chunk of the electorate.
That's right. That's a massive number of voters. And when someone registers to vote, that often leads them to encourage other people they know to register to vote. So it does have a compounding effect over time.
Last but certainly not least, we're going to circle to Shelby County v. Holder. This is the voting rights case that makes it to the Supreme Court, and according to voting rights activists, guts the VRA.
Yes, so the Voting Rights Act had multiple sections to it. Section 2 was designed to make illegal the most obvious laws designed to disenfranchise people. So it is the tool to invalidate poll taxes, literacy tests, and the like. But there are two other parts, important parts of the Voting Rights Act. They were the parts that dealt with jurisdictions with a long history of voting discrimination. And as you said before, Anna, they put those jurisdictions under what was called a preclearance requirement, which meant if, for example, the state of Alabama wanted to change an election law in 2008 or 2010, they had to get the approval in advance of the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. What Shelby County v. Holder did was a divided Supreme Court in a 5-4 ruling held that the preclearance formula was out of date and that the notion of preclearance was constitutionally permissible, but the preclearance formula had not been updated since the 1960s, and Alabama had by that point seen a dramatic increase in African-American voter registration and turnout rates. And so the majority in Shelby County held that the preclearance formula was unconstitutional because it was using data that was 50 years out of date. What is interesting is, although there is a lot of controversy in the jurisdictions that once were covered by the Voting Rights Act, we are still seeing super high turnout levels in every battleground state, including those that were subject to heightened scrutiny under the Voting Rights Act. And some Democratic Party activists in the South, including in the NAACP, have noted that in areas where there's a new voter ID law passed, the controversy over it can often lead to a backlash that increases turnout because it becomes such a big public issue. And so that, I would say, would be a hopeful indication that despite the Voting Rights Act being limited in the decision a decade ago, we still are seeing that the vast majority of Americans who are eligible to vote having the opportunity to vote.
It also sounds like the Congress could theoretically come back and update the formula, although I guess I'll say good luck with that.
You know, it's interesting. The Republican Party in Congress actually supported the Voting Rights Act for decades, including the Section 4 and Section 5.
Majority-minority districts.
Yes, exactly.
We talked about this when we covered redistricting, yeah.
Yes, so I'm sure your listeners are familiar with that. But I think at this point it would be a surprise if we were to see any change to the Voting Rights Act. I think Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is where all the action is now. There's a new case coming up out of Louisiana. We're certainly going to continue to see litigation over it. But I would be surprised if Congress would ever update the preclearance formula to be constitutionally viable again.
And just a quick reminder, if you forget your ID, your naturalization papers, if you forget anything that you need to vote today, you can vote provisionally, and then you can come back later, tomorrow or the next day, and provide the documentation, and your vote will be counted. I want to say thank you to Ohio State University Law Professor Anthony Goggin for this trip through the American ballot history. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anne. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you all so much for listening to All Sides on this election day. Go out and vote. And come back tomorrow for election results right here on 89.7 NPR News.